So why don't you guys buckle up and join the ride because we're going to have some fun.
Going green.
And Abby said you shouldn't commit illegal acts except perhaps at night and with your parents' permission.
Your advice is making less sense than usual.
Well, the important thing is family and friendship, honesty, values, and no one got arrested.
You see this jerk?
This is the same thing. Kropotkin was the same jerk, and Bakunin was the same jerk. Not good. Not good, I'm telling you.
He was a very good dancer.
He's a moment.
George Orwell, who definitely didn't like socialism of any kind, warned us against it. He wrote books that said that totalitarianism is bad and that sticking with old ideas is good.
I got news for you. You gotcha. The population again.
I did not know that.
I never thought you'd lose a Stalin debate.
You never expect to walk into one.
Sure.
Avoid Marxism. Or telling her you're a Trotskyite.
Trotskyist. Only a Stalinist would call the Trotskyist a Trotskyite. And I'm not a Trotskyist anymore. I'm a Maoist.
Relentlessly anti-Trump and relentlessly pro somebody like Obama.
I'm not pro-Obama. I've been a critic of Obama. I'm a critic of the Democratic Party.
Because
I'm literally a communist.
Well, you know how it is. The main thing is to get those juicy likes and subscribes. And we can get some more of that sweet, sweet communist money rolling in. You know how it is, bro. Gotta get the communist dollar, gotta make it to the top.
Just imagine somebody saying under cannibalism or under slavery or under dictatorship, well, there's nothing you can do about it. Well, they'd be wrong. There is something you can do about it. You can get beyond these archaic systems and move closer and closer to fulfilling human capacities. And that's what we need to do.
Welcome to the Three Left Show. I'm your host, Dan Platt, here in the studio, as always. This is the left-wing reading hour where I take a bunch of random points, stories, articles, and string them together based on a topic or a set of ideas and try to add my contribution to the conversation. This week's episode is mostly going to concentrate on electoralism again. Please don't go yet. I feel I have something to contribute. In fact, I know so. No more equivocating / apologizing. I'm going to go aggro this episode. I'm going to speak with confidence, assertiveness that I, in fact, am right. That is my conceit this episode. I am right and others are wrong. I don't do that enough because I come from a place of honesty. I say when I don't know something, I'm not completely confident. I do that to be nice, for the benefit of my friends, when I disagree with what they're doing, we're doing something different than each other, and I, you know, for their benefit as well as my own, because I would like people to give me the benefit of the doubt that I know what I'm doing, and I want to trust them that they know what they're doing. When I do not want to put them down and say you don't know what you're doing, because I'm not, I consider that like bullying behavior of some type. Yeah, you know, I usually I take that stance. Because I don't want to lose friends. I have so few as it is. so little community. I don't want to lose what I have, right? It makes me very anxious to consider losing people over a disagreement, not in politics or goals, right? But strategy and tactics. What are you doing? Who are you voting for? Why would you vote for them? What's the underlying ideas? Is this that makes a difference on the outcome, right? Usually because there's an intention of what comes next. So many different areas and directions to come at the question of the presidential election or non-election, whatever. Does it even matter? Likely not. I'm going to come from the place that Biden is going to lose. Not that Trump is going to win, okay? I don't consider him a winner. No one should consider him a winner of anything. It only doesn't help matters, right? But Biden is going to lose. I'm going to come at it from this perspective. Because I'm right, because I have been right, but I have not articulated that any, say, the Bernie movement supporter that, you know, this is the big chance, we're going to shift the Democratic Party left, we can do it, this is the movement that we didn't have 4 years ago, or it'll be different this time, and they'll list all these different things that have happened in the last 4 years of why it's different now, and I'm kind of just standing there, kind of, not quite nodding, right? But not also saying, I think that's inaccurate. So I have a bunch of different kinds of points. So otherwise, this program covers news issues and anything of interest from a radical and revolutionary left perspective for the curious or the committed. promote a post-capitalist present and future via direct democracy and a commons economy. General goals. A left that is of itself and for itself. That was very important this episode. It's a meaning point of socialism, anarchism, and ecology. Those are the three lefts that I refer to. So this show is for going in a different direction. So first, but here's kind of a particular point on why I care about the elections at all, right? Obviously, if you're, you know, because I'm not going to lose friends at this point because I'm already losing them because, you know, Bernie-crats around me are all sad boys now. They either, and I feel like they should know better, saying that, we have to vote for Biden. It's like, that's the conversation I'm seeing in various circles. I mean, of course, the conversation differs from place to place. And in fact, I'm going to cover each of them and why, in particular ways, they're wrong. Or they're just, there's the people who should know better that say, like, we can't do anything else. We have to vote for Biden to prevent a Trump victory. Because they're still thinking in terms of Trump being a winner of some kind and Biden not being a loser. Please accept that the non-likely voters are not showing up. They didn't show up last time a centrist was the candidate, and they're not going to show up now. The enthusiasm gap. Hell, even the people who are supportive aren't really supportive. They said so themselves. They only care about this electability argument. They don't really care about him. So what does that say about the people who aren't likely voters, the people who aren't being polled regularly? They're not going to show up at all. They're not even being asked. Because if they were, you know, the so-called independents, these non, you know, people who aren't affiliated, who aren't in the primary, were switched to vote for Bernie, but then probably didn't get the chance, who weren't allowed to have the chance. So this is from Antonio Nagy. He is a Green Party organizer in South Carolina. Kind of look up to him, though I've yet to actually, I think I've met him. But okay, so for those who say they aren't into electoralism, right? They want to do other types of organizing instead, right? Since it's a dead end of some type, all electoralism, not just in the Democratic Party, because then the assumption is, well, if you're going to do elections, you have to do it in the major parties. You have to do it in the corporate 1% parties. But every other attempt, this is what you need to know. Every other attempt at mass movements and union work in the past few decades, and by a few decades, my lifetime, 40 years, it has all been absorbed by lesser evilism and supporting the Democratic Party machine. This means military, industry, and Wall Street. So you can say you are ignoring the Democratic Party, but as the most effective wing of the ruling class, it's not ignoring you. So that means, like, to be a left of and for itself, to do people-powered politics, you gotta think about elections, at least a little bit. It's a battleground that can't be left undefended, a position. There needs to be opposition there. But that opposition can't be independents running in the Democratic Party, like Sanders. It can't be this kind of nebulous nonprofit coalition like the Justice Democrats, that are basically eventually, you know, in order to get any post that's worth anything, they have to kiss the ring anyway. They have to take orders from the people who are bought. They may not be bought, but in order to pass anything or to have a say in a government body, they have to bow anyway because they're in the party that bows to it. So that's the point itself. On to the next one. Same guy. And he wants to clarify, this one is, and these are Facebook posts, he wants to clarify his critique of Sanders and the dangers of attempting to reform a party ruled by capitalists. That does not in any way conflict with the fact that I recognize the actual economic and social process that is causing this eruption and the crisis within these parties, major ones. Just because there is a potential for a seismic shift along a working class which is expressed in the rise of Sanders, but does not mean that I should bite my tongue and get absorbed into a chorus of uncritical adulation of him. There is no secret as to what has spurred the global pendulum swings from the left to right that are produced by the deepening existential crisis of the system. What was first witnessed in Occupy Wall Street, Ferguson, Baltimore, and other similar uprisings were a direct result of this deepening crisis, the long emergency, it's also called, could be called. It's no surprise that the ascendancy of Sanders and the victory of Trump came as a direct mass response of the failed corporate optimism of the Clintons, the Bushes, and Obama's Hope Brigade. There is no going back to that era. Try as either capitalist party's owners may want to. However, my recognition of all of these contradictions and amazing opportunities that lay before us does not mean that I should take my warnings about the serious dangers of breathing life to a dead donkey and temporarily shove it all in some place for safekeeping. While on one hand, there's just being an inward-looking sectarian and completely diminishing the relevance of what is happening. Now, ultimately, reformist in nature as that may be, there's also just being a rank opportunist for perceived short-term goals for unity of the with the masses. The masses, which are not monolithic, which can shift very quickly, and the plurality of the people still do not vote. Not active, not participants. Many because of a better basic analysis than the average left reformist. You know, they know it's rigged. They know that there are structural barriers to them. So why should they run up against that wall? This is something activists like me had to figure out, or at least learn. You know, I took it from other people, I listened, and then I did it myself and saw for myself the barriers that exist. And it's super hella frustrating. When others then want to tell me that no, they're not there, or they can be overcome. I'm telling you, I couldn't overcome them. Like, yeah, I didn't. You think because you're charismatic or something? And mentioning the past uprisings also brings a point that doesn't come up in the other pieces, which is brought up by some other academic, though, who wants to figure things out and reassess left strategy again, right? Because we're always doing that because we're always failing. And first you acknowledge that it's actually a failure, that these uprisings are in fact defeated because they're not actual like organized efforts, right? They could be, but they're not. I was a participant in Occupy, right? Very much in it. And then part of a working group to continue it. So that argument of like, you know, the Bernie Sanders movement will have a legacy. They have an infrastructure. They build an infrastructure. They have email lists. I'm like, no, that's not actually going to be the case. I mean, it's very optimistic. I mean, you want it to be true. It's not true. I was in a working group with the Occupy Albany email list in front of us. All right. It was 1,000 thick at least, collected from all the people who were into Occupy as it was happening. For the years afterwards, we would send blast after blast of updates of here are opportunities to get involved again, that we don't need a park now that we've all come together, that, you know, you're on this list. You're organized now, but not really. What we would try to encourage an organization, come regularly. We're going to throw parties every now and then, get-togethers, reunions, birthday parties on the anniversary. We did various things, but there was attrition. Less every time. We would have discussions and we would put out on the email list, reactivate Occupy. Let's talk about what our next move is. What do we all want to do? And then we all kind of said our piece. We didn't come to a consensus about one strategy or one type of action. And so everyone just basically went home. Because apparently unless there's one person giving orders, no one could take it on themselves. It's like, well, I won't do this unless like we're all on board. So many other, you know, things going on with that. But what I'm saying is that when a movement is defeated, it is done, right? It is not continuing. There is no infrastructure left because it was an uprising and it was defeated. The momentum is gone. There is no more will to continue it. The standards movement will follow a similar path. I am confident of that. And I'm seeing it in real time. Literally, it took a week. Back to Antonio's post. There is a reason why, despite Trump playing the perfect villain, despite all of Trump's reactionary transgressions and crimes, why anti-war resistance has not recovered even from Clinton-era levels. There is a reason why, despite fantastic evidence of the beginning of a new American labor movement in actions like the West Virginia teacher strike, why such waves have failed to coalesce into a force to be reckoned with like in other countries, like in France. The primary culprit is because another grasp of breath resuscitated another generation's hope in transforming the Democrats into a people's party. And this has given some of the most promising potential revolutionaries jobs. Even the most militant resistance to Trump which we saw come together in 2016, has been largely sidelined into no recognition that it was in fact mostly Democratic mayors who collaborated with the state in Obama's second term in a nationwide coordinated assault on the uprising resistance to Trump in the summer of 2016. So there was all this actual resistance, but it's suppressed by Democratic mayors with their police forces. Because any kind of unrest of any kind, even if it's against dictatorship, is still unacceptable. Instead, continuing, many of the best potential leaders who stepped up from these recent waves of resistance have largely been absorbed into the nonprofit complex. But now the Democratic Party machine itself, well, really, two parts of the same machine. Sadly, we have seen many people who know better echo the dangerous trope, our candidate is the best candidate to stop Trump. No, we are the best candidate to stop Trump. This was realized in Trump's biggest political blow to date when tens of thousands of furloughed FAA workers and contract employees started calling in sick and threatening to bring the entire economy to a grinding halt before the airline unions threatened to follow. We are the ones who can stop Trump. But more importantly, what Trump represents, solidarity and militancy, are the key. But so is the missing ingredient, forging a militant party independent of our enemies in Wall Street. So to me, an important argument for that. But Stephen Greenfield, who is running for Congress again in New York here along the Hudson River Valley, he points out the kind of myth about swing voters that they, it's usually, let's see, there's a forming political consensus in the Beltway, you know, the experts, that swing voters don't exist, that likely voters are partisan. They vote one way always. And so what decides elections are these unlikely voters that kind of show up. Now, they're usually either thought of as being independents, sometimes they are, or they are these moderates that then need to be appealed to by going to, by basically advocating for no change at all, because they just want stability of some kind. Steve Greenfield, Congressional Green Party candidate for Congress, Congressional District 19 in New York, here's his post on swing voters. Based on his experience 2 years ago when he ran for the same congressional seat. Swing voters do exist. It's who they are and how and why they vote that is being willfully ignored by mainstream liberal political analysis, which is why Democrats lose seemingly unlosable elections. There are three different sets of swing voters. The one everyone calls the swing voters, which is a very, very small and as close to 100% white as you can get without dealing in absolutes. Like ivory soap. Another, we now know, although all of us on the progressive to left spectrum have always said to deaf ears, has at least 15 million people. And who knows how many more out there, a vast 100 million non-voting population, but at least 15 million, is extremely diverse educationally, economically, and ethnically. They are comprised overwhelmingly of New Deal and Great Society liberals, as far as their worldview is concerned. What was, prior to 1992, a perfectly ordinary, generally accepted mainstream tendency in the Democratic Party that has produced all of the biggest Dem victories over the last 90 years, including Obama. As although he did not serve their interests, his rhetoric was aimed directly at them. He wanted their affirmative votes, which are a much larger number than their nose-holding votes that he got, and he got them. The third are what we now call Trumpists. They are built over the course of 30 years of hate speech and disinformation of Rush Limbaugh, the Hannitys, Fox News, and Breitbart, and the major corporations that fund their programming. They trend without higher education and are also nearly completely white and Christian because these, you know, right-wing media is funded by certain capitalists. It's not like they're funded by viewer donations and mass support like we, like media that actually does serve you and can act as a counterweight and or counterbalance or competition for right-wing media. Democrats have been pretending the second group doesn't exist since 1976. As a result, even on the race instances, when they've won, they've produced the public dismay that gave us Reagan, Cheney, and Trump, meaning a backlash because they don't actually deliver on the rhetoric. to New Deal Democrats, New Deal liberals. The Democrats now recognize the second group exists, so naturally, the reaction is to blame it for Trump, to McCarthyistically accuse it of being a fifth column for Russia, and to do everything possible to prevent it from nominating the candidate of its choice. This would mean the movement for Bernie Sanders, which is, as argued, New Deal liberalism, which is why I'm not part of it, because I'm not for New Deal liberalism. We did that already. Time for something else, something better, something that's less racist, less nationalist, put it that way. Continuing the sentence, and in the hope that they succeed at that and again leave many millions of voters frustrated and angry, blame it in advance should Trump win again. Blaming us, meaning the left. The left is already being blamed for everything. Why not just accept it? Why not, you know, why pretend that, like, we want to be friends? I'm done with that. I've been done with that for the last 10 years. It has not gotten me very far in local politics, I can assure you. So there are downsides. But, yeah, no regrets. Many people ask me why I devote so much of my writing to attacking Democrats when the Republicans are worse. My response is simple. It's the Democrats that are the barrier to us being able to get at the Republicans. Those swing voters they're expending all their power to protect, they're white Republicans. Matt Fulitello, who is also a congressional Green candidate in New York, he had a point about, you know, Bernie's failure. I think it's been mentioned by other Bernie Sanders fans that he was kind of flip-flopping slash inconsistent on what the campaign was really for. And I think that's hopefully coming into stark relief that it was to pull the Democrats left. It wasn't to win, you see. And even though that's what everyone was kind of in it for, they wanted him to win. Not because of Bernie being, you know, a guy who hasn't really, let's see, as they put it, he doesn't know how to talk about anything past 1985. And there are a lot of people stuck in the 80s with their thinking. A lot of people. Goes across the board. And that thinking, which is the DSA's thinking, or any kind of accommodationist that, like, we pull the Democrats left by joining them or by caucusing with them, even if we're not in the party, like being independent, no party. But we're not going to be in a different party because that would actually be oppositional. That way we can accommodate them without taking complete orders, but we're going to be friends with them. And so what's the difference? Others have pointed out that when Sanders actually said that Biden could beat Trump, that was also like conceding. Everyone cares about electability, so you should really be making the electability argument all the time. But instead, it goes between, we're for a political revolution, this is about winning. But it turns out, the whole time, and I saw this, political revolution means pulling the Democrats left. It doesn't mean changing anything, just pulling them left. And that's apparent. That's changing everything. Wrong. What was his other points? Why didn't Bernie just run as an independent? Why do you do this in the Democratic primary where voting can be suppressed, as it was? And again, just like with anyone that I talk to, even on a local level, even if you're running on a different line than the Democrats, that gives you more time to campaign. And as being a independent, meaning not someone with a machine behind you, which then includes nested, like a nesting doll, 50 other people that will go out who are already respected in the community to say, this person's okay, you can vote for them. That doesn't exist. So you need more time to either win the community leaders over who aren't tied down in the machine, which is hard and takes time. Then there's the canvassing. You need more time to do all that. And you have more time if you're on the general election ballot, not the primary ballot. Because here in New York, the primary has actually moved up. You have even less time than before. Before it was at the end of the summer, now it's at the beginning of the summer. Why would you give yourself less time? It's just thought of as being an advantage because in the general election, everyone votes for the Democrat. But the vote turnout is 3%. So if you have another quote-unquote 3% of the voting population come out for you, then you cancel that out. Because more Democrats vote in the primary, you know, they're more likely to. So, but you can change that math, that calculation, that all of the, you know, standard consultants use. Things are still not loading, but I do have two other articles that don't kind of, I'm not making a through line with everything, but I just wanted to get all the Bernie Sanders critiques out first. You know, he did sign a contract long ago saying that he would endorse whoever was the winner of the primary. although that hasn't really, that was like at the convention, so that hasn't actually kicked in yet, so everything he's doing now is voluntary. Now, is being Bernie or bust really do nothing? There's a lot of Zoomers, younger people, and people my age who are considering Bernie or bust. Bust to mean do nothing, to not vote at all. And that, and then that becomes the debate of, you know, Bernie or bust versus ride in with Biden, even if you hate everything about the action of doing that, of voting for Biden. Because doing nothing is, of course, worse. So the debate is not nothing or Biden. It's Biden or vote left or build a left, which, of course, takes more time. But it's made up of a lot of other smaller actions. Yeah, so let's go through two things that I have in front of me. So one is, yes, and that, now I've done that. Don't vote for Joe Biden, the case for the Green Party in 2020. This is just a standard media blog post, Medium blog post, by Daniel Kashmar. This is good. I don't know this guy, which is a good sign. I like seeing new names, because if it was always like someone I knew as a upper person in the Green Party, then that would just be like, it's the same five people. We're not growing. Where are these new voices? Now, actually, our support since Bernie threw in the towel, so to speak, endorsed Biden. Support for the Green Party has grown, this is in material dollars, 400%. Basically means that we can now fund our actual get-on-the-ballot drives, our ballot drives. Because it's really frustrating to see people like disregard the Green Party or say like, well, you got to vote for Biden. The Green Party isn't on the ballot in most states. Like, you know, there's a needs to be a ballot drive every election cycle, right? We need money and we need canvassers to do that. So it always comes down to like, no thanks to you, we're not on the ballot in these other states. I don't like people complaining about things they could have done something about. If it's something that I could have done something about but didn't, then I'm not complaining about it. I'm just going to say, it would be nice if that was the case. But I'm not going to say it wouldn't be worth doing option A if I had done it. But that's, of course, that's why I'm in the Green Party in the first place, because I know that it's necessary to have this, independent left-wing party that does all the things that people want a third party, this hypothetical new third party to do. But when I ask them to articulate why the Green Party doesn't do those things, I get vagaries. I get, well, they're not serious. And then, of course, it always turns into circular reasoning. Well, why aren't they serious? Because they don't do X, Y, and Z. And then I bemoan that X, Y, and Z doesn't get done. We want to do those things, but we need more support. We need more volunteers. We need your help. But you won't help because we're not serious. We'd be serious. What stops us from being serious? Why makes you think we're not serious? Because of perception, and I don't have this queued up, but it was a joke article, satirical, kind of like The Onion, but not funny. It was there's pointing out that the joke was there's two things that people know about the Green Party, that were hippies and that were losers. Daniel Kashmar's kind of piece. Now, this is just a general outline of all of the different kind of, not all of them, of course, but a good number of points that I'll just re-articulate for this episode. I've kind of covered some of them in the past. As Bernie Sanders has now endorsed Joe Biden, Biden supporters are expecting Bernie ones to simply fall in line and support Joe. I don't think we should do that. So this is someone who is a Sanderista. We should do that because we have nothing to gain from it. Nearly every argument in favor of Joe Biden, like the Supreme Court, can be contradicted by his political history. For example, Biden voted to approve Antonin Scalia. He voted for the Republican conservative judges on the court now. His treatment of Anita Hill in the past, and saying, who was a previous, you know, potential appointee, but then slapped her down, and saying Obama's Supreme Court pick shouldn't be too liberal. We would all have a greater impact on electoral politics if we voted Green Party. The Green Party. And by the way, again, he's just making the argument for voting Green Party. I go further and say, no, you got to be a participant. Because the Green Party isn't, if circular reasoning, we're not, we're voting for without mass support, right? And that's why a lot of people disregard. We're not, we're voting for. Why aren't we, we're voting for? Because we don't have mass support. Aren't you part of the masses? The Green Party is at the left of the Democrats on virtually every issue, but they poll in relative obscurity. If we want a government that represents us and works in our foreign interests, hypothetically, we want the way we vote needs to change immediately. Now, we are in a winner-take-all election. This is both an argument against supporting minor parties at all, but to me, I turn it around and say, no, because it's winner-take-all, because there are this mass of likely voters that outnumber us, then there's no point in voting with them. They're going to take your money anyway and run with it. There are many forms of voter suppression and disenfranchisement in the United States, but the one I'm going to focus on is the winner-take-all voting. With winner-take-all, many votes across the country simply don't matter. If you live in a deep blue state, vote Republican. Your vote doesn't matter. If you live in a deep red state and vote Democrat, your vote doesn't matter, literally. Of course, this is not the case for swing states, as the argument goes, but I don't really care about the swing state argument either. Because within swing states, there are localities where it's the same dynamic. You have one type of likely voter that outnumbers another type of likely voter. That's where in these Democratic cities, when they exist, a section of Republicans will be registered Democrats so they can vote in local primaries and actually have an impact, not overall like on mayor's race, but like in their ward, so that in the ward primary, it will actually be like one of them. They'll outnumber the number of Democrats in certain neighborhoods, you know, white, upper middle class neighborhoods. In Arkansas, Trump beat Clinton with around 60% of the vote, but he received 100% of the state's electoral votes. Those 380,000 people who voted for Clinton had no effect on the outcome of the race in Arkansas, nor in the country. However, if they voted for the Green Party instead, their total vote count, it would have raised it by 20%. Ultimately, nothing would have changed in 2016. Hillary Clinton would have still lost Arkansas in the election, but it would have had a meaningful impact on future leftist causes. It hasn't been mentioned yet. If a minor party gets 5% of a national presidential vote, they are recognized as a higher tier party, official, more formal, and then they qualify for more funds from the federal government. It goes for all aspects of life. In fact, continuing, anyone who settled for Clinton wasted their votes in the end. We didn't get anything for it. Now, Joe Biden, the candidate for the Democrats, has not even moved to the left of Hillary Clinton in 2016 on the most important issues because we all demonstrated that we, referring to himself and other Bernie-crats, would vote for the Democrat no matter what. Voting blue no matter who means you're settling. Settling for not Trump, which is, to me, a really low place to be. Currently, I think the Howie Hawkins motto is now hashtag never settle. Because we can't afford to right now. You're not just losing a little dignity or some wages or a few hours of work. We're losing our lives. We're losing our complete autonomy. Now, here's the argument from negotiating with the DNC. When you buy a car, and he uses like a buying a car market. So this I'm kind of iffy on with this argument, but I'm going to make it anyway and give my own little take on it. When you buy a car, do you shop around or do you buy the first car you see? I have a problem with this because he's comparing voting and political participation like it's a consumer choice, like it's buying a car. I don't like doing that for obvious reason. Politics and life should not be commodities to be bought and sold. Our participation and to act as citizens is not like buying toothpaste. It's not something to be advertised to you about. It's just something to actually learn and grow as people. However, if there is serious competition for, you know, buying your car, the car salesman will do what it takes to get the sale. The same can be said of voting, currently, at least in the upside-down way that it's done. If you agree to vote for Joe Biden without him giving major concessions, like any kind of Medicaid for all, Green New Deal nominally being two of the most important, then he has no incentive to move left at all. He hasn't even unendorsed fracking or new gas drilling. He knows he has your vote, and so he doesn't need to work for it. However, if you're willing to wait for those major concessions or even vote for the Green Party, it signals to the DNC that they can't just force terrible candidates on you. They will need to actually earn your vote. I find this argument to be a little non-effective because I heard it a lot amongst Bernie Sanders supporters in 2016 and the year after. And all those people just did the Bernie Sanders movement again. They had already decided 2017 that they were going to go for, you know, we're going to build up a bigger and better Sanders campaign. So the Democrats have to earn our vote. How well has that worked? I would have liked to have built a better Green Party in the last 4 years, but you guys wanted to build a better Bernie Sanders movement, which has its structural deficiencies as a strategy, okay? Not in the spirit of building some of our own power, but you are building that power inside a primary election that was going to be rigged against you anyway, just like the first time. Because I was seeing over the last 4 years, 3 years, what was happening to prevent the fraud again? What was being done to prevent the same voter suppression? If anything, it was being intensified. And the only way to really fight those trends is to have our own power. That means having our own organization. And also, I wasn't building up my local Green Party the way I probably should have because I was doing the show. I made a conscious choice after 2016, or 2017 actually, that I was going to do this community media thing. Because it was more important for me to identify the people who are on my side and actually doing things together or inspiring you to do things with the other people who agree with you. Organizing is power, underlined. If a large enough group of us threaten to vote for the Green Party or even does vote for them, the DNC will need to acknowledge this. In the end, the DNC is responsible for voter apathy. It's their responsibility to turn people into voters. Contrary to popular belief, those apathetic non-voters and minor party voters are not privileged. We can make it easier for them to reach out to us by creating a single large group of us, such as Green Party voters. There is power in numbers. Because currently, Bernie Sanders voters are a conglomeration of various types, pseudo-movements, demographics that are all showing up to the Sanders rallies. And they're being organized not by an organization, though I'm sure there's plenty of them there, but they're all democratic socialist organizations that still have this line about how we can change the Democratic Party, that we need to work with them, the reforms that we propose and organize around kind of have to be halfway. Okay, so first he has a edit that he made yesterday. This is a response to one or two people claiming that this logic only gives Joe Biden, the DNC, an incentive to move right, not left. This claim is demonstrably wrong in two ways. One, this is likely based on Chuck Schumer saying that for every blue-collar Democrat that we lose in western Pennsylvania, we will pick up two moderate Republicans in the suburbs of Philadelphia. And you can repeat that in Ohio, Illinois, Wisconsin, etc. The Democrats lost in these states to Donald Trump. The logic of appealing to the right clearly did not work. The 2020 Democratic presidential candidates proposed some of the most progressive policies we've ever seen from Democrats. For example, UBI, total student debt cancellation. Of course, all these things were backtracked in one way or another. More than doubling the minimum wage, Medicaid for all, and the Green New Deal, nominally. This is because Bernie Sanders forced a shift in the Democratic Party left. I don't believe that. If anything, pushing for a leftward swing pushed more Dems rightward into an intransigent stability, holding on to stability, and just getting rid of Trump and returning to normalcy is not all that's required, of course, but just mostly required before we do anything else. fight for anything else. But of course, you ask them, well, what do you fight for normally? And you get milquetoast stuff. That's usually my challenge to any kind of person saying, you know, voter apathy this and rig system that. And like, well, what are you doing about it? I'm fighting for it with the, you know, with via several organizations by doing community work. What are you doing? Are you voting apathy? Are you canvassing in some way? Are you doing it in a way where you're learning something from it? Where you're not just canvassing likely voters like yourself, but the non-likely voters. That's the hard part. That's the thing that really gets you maybe out of your comfort zone of thinking of the establishment lines about just thinking about the likely voters. Likely voters are only voters. And even Green Party people get stuck in this. And when it comes to the question of winning actual local elections, it all comes down to the likely voters, who are the people who are likely to vote, and get out the vote. And even then, it's still really hard to activate people. And the enthusiasm gap. So let's reiterate the argument I made about how Biden will lose. This is all brings out us to the enthusiasm gap between Biden and Donald Trump. Trump supporters fervently support him and would figuratively, and no doubt for some literally, swim across a river to vote for him. Biden supporters are not nearly as enthused. Anecdotally, when I hear Biden supporters speak of him, they always say something along the lines of, he wasn't my first or second choice. He wasn't even my 10th choice. But we have to vote for him to stop Trump. Does that sound like someone who cares? Cares about beating Trump, I guess. In 2016, we learned we couldn't put all of our faith into traditional polling methods. Hillary Clinton beat Donald Trump in almost every single poll, and in one of them, she was leading him by 14 points. Yet she still lost. There are many factors in a campaign, but one thing that connects every losing presidential campaign in modern years is enthusiasm gap. Where it matters, not in the likely voters who are being asked and talked to, the ones that say, I'm going to vote for Biden because Trump needs to be beaten and his gang. We need Biden and his gang. No, we don't. I know. One gang is doing more damage than the other. Not in the ways that matter, folks. 53% of Trump supporters are very enthusiastic about supporting him. Contrast that with the quarter of Biden supporters that are actually enthusiastic about supporting him. John McCain lost with 17% of his supporters identifying as very enthusiastic. Mitt Romney lost with 23%. And Hillary Clinton lost with 32%. That's a larger percentage than what Joe Biden has. So there are more people who are actually excited to vote for Hillary Clinton than Joe Biden. What does that say about the outcome that is going to occur? He's already lost, folks. It was already a done deal. All those electability arguments, all the people that voted for Biden and what I mean is they were fooling themselves in the thinking that anyone would actually, and not just them, but non-likely voters, people who are registered, who do vote, but only like on presidential races, only once every 4 years. Joe Biden did relatively well during the one-on-one debate with Bernie Sanders because moderators did not fact-check him when he lied about his political history. In fact, he's overall had a very supportive media backing him during these recent months. Understatement. This is perfectly illustrated by the New York Times admitting that they deleted a damaging portion of a sentence because the Biden campaign asked them, what will happen when Biden has to face an unfriendly media, an unfriendly competitor, and unfriendly moderators? We've already seen him lose his temper during this campaign trail. What will happen when the president antagonizes him? As the campaign is right now, I don't see his path to victory. No one can argue that Trump is a good president. In fact, he may be the worst of all time. But Biden has been effectively a non-entity during this entire pandemic. When he does show himself, we get embarrassing sound bites and clips that the Republicans will use in their attack ads. Social distancing is communism, folks. Remember that. The Democratic candidates of 2020 who now endorse Joe Biden brought up legitimate issues with his political history and questioned his judgment. Voted for Iraq War, et cetera, you know, we'll go on. Another edit from yesterday. This is a response to some people saying that Joe Biden has better policies than Trump. You can see debates about this all over the internet, so I'm not going to waste time on that here, but I will write that it's beside the point. Let's just assume that Biden has amazing policies. None of those policies will matter if he doesn't actually win. The entire point of running for president as a major party candidate is to win the general election. Right now, Joe Biden and the DNC are not doing what it takes to win, which is to earn the votes of the left through real policy concessions. And this is a similar point about Sanders, that he didn't run the win. He wasn't actually about convincing the many people he needed to that he was electable, that he would beat Trump, that it wasn't about just shifting the party left. Because that was, you know, but of course, then the argument made, which is one that I was very much on board with, was, well, it's not really about mobilizing the likely voters in the primary. It's about getting all the people who are sort of likely, but even non-likely voters to do that. But those were the demographics that were not going to risk their lives to vote in the primaries when they were still put on during a pandemic. And they still needed vigorous get out the vote efforts for them to come out in the first place, to be activated, which was, you know, it's a good assumption that they would be. But as probably I told you sewing boomers would say, they knew that there wouldn't be enough younger people coming out in the polls to counterbalance all of the people who think like them. That it's not so much not liking Sanders, though there's part of that, but just that Sanders will not beat Trump for reasons like the right wing will call him a socialist, and this will scare the likely moderate voters away. Not that it will excite non-likely voters, because they're very cynical. They know that people who are not likely to vote are not likely to vote. And then I asked, like, well, do you want to do something about making it more likely that all these people, these demographics, would vote? And it's like, sure. Okay. What are you doing? Are you lobbying? Are you, you know, organizing? Are you creating a money fund or something for get out the vote? That isn't like a threat like vote or die or vote because it's fun. Last part here. Looking back and forward, if we all would have voted for Green Party in 2016, like I did, nothing would have changed in that election, but the DNC would have never attempted to cross us again, us being an actual consolidated left. Instead, there was a consolidation around Joe Biden right before Super Tuesday on the other side, and that this would have not likely happened if Bernie Sanders had been the presumptive candidate for the Democrats right now. He would have been the compromise between a growing Green Party and moderate Democrats. As things are currently, but of course, this is an argument of why didn't this guy join the Green Party in 2016? What was his thought process, you know? I welcome him now. I regret that it took this long. I thought the lessons of 2016 were pretty clear, but, you know, takes another failure to sink in, I guess. You know, you have to try it twice. Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. Now, shame on me means, okay, this time I actually made the mistake of trying this again. Now I'm going to try something different. There are 7 months until the election. I look forward to seeing what concessions Biden is willing to give us, or I will look forward to voting for the Green Party. So this is an interesting kind of argument, because he's not actually like for building the Green Party. He's just talking about voting for the Green Party to get concessions from Biden, as if that's actually like a possibility. So again, it's like, come on, go all the way. You're still holding on to this. We're going to shift the party left. We're going to shift Biden, and it's going to matter. Get real. All right, moving on to the mid-show break. Thank you for listening to Three Left Show. This has been your Ranter-in-Chief, Dan Platt.
There's an election on again, and it's terrible to see the farce they call American democracy. On the left is someone who is to the right of Tony Blair. On the right is a neo-fascist, narcissistic billionaire. At least within the corporate press, it's all about these two. The candidates who've got all the dollar signs in view. Meanwhile, off the spectrum is someone they don't mention. They don't think the Republic can handle the dissension. The only progressive woman You'll see listed in most states, the only one whose dinners cost a couple bucks a plate, the only one whose platform makes any sense to me, the only one I like to picture running the country. I'm voting for Jill Stein. I'm going green. They say I'm throwing my vote away. I don't know what they mean. I'm voting for Jill Stein. I'm going green. On the one hand, a guy who believes in getting rich at any price. On the other, a warmonger who makes Thatcher look nice. Or you can vote the party that will bring full employment as it cuts the military budget by over 50% with the Green Jobs Program all across the country, so we can pull back from the brink with renewable energy. Cause the future is clear. We won't have one if we don't have a government that can get the job done. I'm voting for Jill Stein. I'm going green. They say I'm throwing my vote away. I don't know what they mean. I'm voting for Jill Stein. I'm going green. You could roll over, play dead, vote for the 1%. And wonder in the future where your world went. Or you can go with your conscience, give it a try. Before Trump and Clinton kill us, we gotta kiss it all goodbye. I'm voting for Jill Stein. I'm going green. They say I'm throwing my vote away. I don't know what they mean. I'm voting for Jill Stein. I'm going green. I'm voting for Jill Stein. I'm going green. They say I'm throwing my vote away. I don't know what they mean. I'm voting for Jill Stein. I'm going green. I'm voting for Jill Stein. I'm going green.
And I'm back. I'm your host, Dan Platt. Case for minor party politics in general, but particularly the Green Party if you are Bernie-crat or Bernie Sanders fan. Now, I don't think I know this guy, but another Facebook post that I saved is from Sergio Siano, which I liked. It's a statement that we can replace the Democratic Party with the Green Party in terms of statue and ballot placement. So here's a really big, go big or go broke. Centrist Democrats are terrible fundraisers, and few of their supporters canvass or phone bank. Without Bernie's fundraising and volunteers, they will lose. And trust me, as I warned months ago, Bernie's volunteers are not going to help Biden. So they will lose the Republicans. Even if Dem strategists decide to replace Biden with, checks notes, anybody but Bernie, they will lose the Republicans. I don't see a reason to continue supporting the feigned opposition corporate party that shares none of my values and wants to change nothing. The only four-year solution I see going forward, this is for him, is to help the Green Party get 5% of the vote in 2020 and work like hell to get them the W in 2024. I haven't vetted Howie Hawkins or Dowry Hunter, who's the other candidate, but the Green Party platform objectively provides the only plausible solutions to all of our most consequential issues. I don't expect Howie to win, but we need to get him to 5% in 2020. You hear that? Because it's not really about the man. Because the Green Party doesn't have leaders. Okay? We're leader full. We have a lot of... We're a network of activists. Okay, but first, some naysayers and why it's like a kind of support, but it's a false support. It's frustrating with people who should know better and should be allies and in our tent. You know, because we are on the same side. It's just that there are these biases that prevent a united strategy of sorts, at least electorally speaking. You know, the activism, of course, can be, you know, a thousand flowers blooming, direct action, you know, militant stuff. But again, it is a battle of strategies between being more militant, more independent, more oppositional, and if we're nice enough and lobby, we'll get a Green New Deal that cuts emissions. On Democracy Now!, I saw a headline. I didn't actually listen to it because I don't need to, because I've been listening to it for a decade. Angela Davis, veteran and respected writer, activist, second wave feminist, was declaring her support, as several Bernie Sanderistas have done in the last several years, actually, even while they're, you know, doing a Bernie Sanders bump. We need a third party. We need, rather not a third party, a new party for labor and that fights against sexism, racism, homophobia, transphobia, and ableism. Add that in there. And I'm like, well, the Green Party does all that. Here's the conversation, hypothetically. Angela Davis and a bunch of others say, we need a new party. And I feel like, are we invisible? Is the Green Party invisible? It's like throwing a little bit of shade, a little bit of passive aggressiveness. It's to say that the Green Party is not any of those things, because it's assumed that we're only hippies and losers, and we focus, as mainstream media would say, we focus on environmental issues, or we prioritize them, but nothing else. But really, we are just a left-wing party. But really, we're also kind of a big tent, and that's an internal Green Party problem, which I might circle back to again. But first, an opinion piece in New York USA Today. It always has to be an opinion piece, because actual reporting on minor parties is amazingly short, curt, and biased. So an opinion piece is at least you get some kind of actual, like, points. Voters need more third-party options. Americans should demand it. Now, this is to say that the Libertarian, Green Party, and the other more revolutionary, even smaller parties are not enough. That's why I read in the last electoral special a piece by a student that was just saying, join minor parties, right? Not just that there's need more of them, that we should just join them so that they are options. They're only options if they have mass support. But instead, you get this mamby-pamby, I don't know, I don't have the right language right now, but it's frustrating. It's like, oh, we need a third party, we need a new party, we need a left-wing party. And you ask them, why isn't the Green Party that fits all of your descriptors and needs? And you ask them, why not just join the Green Party? Help us build that option. And they're like, they're not serious. They are not serious. Well, I don't consider you to be serious because you're not building your third party. You keep calling for a third party, Angela Davis, veteran activist, people who died. And I'm like, you're not doing it. Bill McKibben, he built an organization to fight for government intervention on climate change. Right, he built that nonprofit. Other arguments about it aside, he built it. He didn't say, we need an organization that fights for climate change. He did it. Stop saying what you want to do and do it. But the problem with saying we need a new party while you're ignoring the Green Party is that it seems to be a blank spot, that this has already been done a dozen times. That these new parties have been created over my lifetime and 90 years, and they've all failed after two, three, four, like one, they couldn't last a single election cycle. That's why no one like remembers them. They're like short-lived sitcoms that didn't have a cultural reach outside of their decade because they were so of their time. The Green Party, which is why it's that it has some staying power. It's 25 years old now. You can say, well, what has it done in that time? Well, it still exists. That's more that can be said of these other labor parties that have been created, these new parties that are being proposed now that I would also expect would only last 2 years. These draft Bernie for a third party group. I don't know what they're doing now. Okay. So this is written by Anil Simon, who's an opinion contributor, and this is the USA Today. The only path to victory is through the two major parties. It's a two-party system, man, which means our options are determined by partisans and activists. So this guy, you know, libertarians and Green Party aren't really the third parties we need, because this is a moderate speaking who's talking about how the major parties are actually too partisan, too extreme. They're too radical. They want changes. I don't like it. In any other country, Joe Biden and I would not be in the same party, Representative Cortez of New York said, and she's right. Cortez and her preferred presidential candidate, Bernie Sanders, are self-described democratic socialists. In every other political system, they would belong to a far-left party like DeLinka, or maybe it was something like it. Otherwise, Michael Bloomberg is also no Democrat. Bloomberg was elected mayor as a Republican, not important. Maybe it's just the tone of this article that I'm really ranting about. I don't really care to read it. You can read it yourself. All links in the show notes on the site, 3lefts.news. Why isn't it Sanders, who remains technically an independent, or Bloomberg, a former Republican, running as either an independent or a member of a third party? Why do they both feel the need to compete for the helm of the pledge fealty to a political party whose platform seems inconsistent with their policies? Well, that's a good question. The answer is that our electoral system, although designed by patriots with a healthy skepticism for political parties, have been reconfigured to make it impossible to challenge from the outside of the partisan duopoly. Sanders and Bloomberg both know this, which is why they have eschewed an independent run in the mold of a Ross Perot or Teddy Roosevelt in favor of the Democratic Party nomination process. They're not wrong. I should know. I tried. In 2018, I ran for the U.S. Senate, raised more than $1.8 million, and polled as high as 18%. But I confronted barriers every step of the way, preventing new competition. I learned is one area. Okay, this is why I'm reading this. This is a guy who ran as an independent and found that without a party to organize with, that he was alone, that there were barriers that he couldn't overcome that prevent new competition. I learned in one area where our two major parties work well together. It starts with restricting ballot access to and debate exposure for congressional races and gerrymandering them. Closed primaries and warped campaign finance laws have been honed by party bosses to protect incumbents, and they're preferred by their base, a base of owners and capitalists, or educated professionals. Simply being listed on the ballot is tough and expensive. In 2016, when Evan McMullen ran as an independent and received 22% of the vote in Utah, he was able to gain ballot access in only 10 other states. Green Party currently has access in 20, and that's just a base amount. With our ballot access drive, we'll likely double that. I think Jill Stein was on the ballot in 42 states. It was a very high amount. We only couldn't get on the ballot in like smaller states like Idaho or something. Party insiders are also making it excruciatingly difficult to be included in debates. And this isn't just like the DNC and the RNC, like on a local level. It becomes a circular reasoning comes from the League of Women Voters. These are the people that should be running the debates. But locally, they run debates for races that are close or contentious or like there's actually a tension. So it's like, no, we won't have a debate between a Green and a Dem because nobody cares. That's literally the reasoning. It's like, oh, it's not worth it. We have limited resources. We can only do so many debates during the month. And I believe them because it's a group of five, ten women, though they do have more ample resources. The truth is that in 2020, the only path to victory is for the two major parties. Though there's different ways of determining victory, but in this case, actually holding president. Which means that our options are determined by the minority of loyal partisans and activists who show up to vote. It's interesting, like, to note that as far as the DNC is concerned, the partisans and activists being referred to are, in fact, the moderates and not actually the Bernie Sanders supporters. Because if it was determined by this extreme position, then, things would have turned out differently, wouldn't it? The result is widespread apathy, even disgust for two bad options, options which in recent years have been opposed by a majority of Americans. A political system that both parties continually tweak each election cycle to present voters with polarizing candidates. And here's where this guy kind of loses me, is it's two parties that work well together to reduce competition, but then they're increasingly polarizing, right? As far as two teams go, two sports teams, two wrestlers, take your pick for your analogy. But it's not really a fight between policy or whatever. Not really. It's really who's going to profit. If Americans truly want a third option or more options in politics, then that's the thing. Then he just puts it as a third option because we talk of third parties, like they just need a third one. But of course, the political continuum is way more than three polls because that's like saying that the Dems are like the left party and if you're any kind of left winger, then you should be in there. And he's talking about a third party for people who don't consider themselves left or right. Because Neil Simon is a Maryland business executive and 2018 independent candidate for Senate. He has a new forthcoming book The Contract to Unite America. And I guess he's a big contributor in Real Clear Politics. Real Clear Publishing is who's publishing it. So again, so then my challenge slash complaint rant is, okay, you say you want this to open up things, and let's see. If Americans want a third option in politics, they will have to pressure lawmakers to pass these reforms. Okay, where is the movement to do that? Is this guy going to start an organization? No, he's not. Weak. At least Bill McKibben started 350.org. But this guy, he's not creating, well, actually, some of them do, but they are so ineffectual, so unpopular, because it's really just a party for these moderate business owners. It's a party of, they're literally a network of activists who maybe have more money than, you know, us Green parties. I at least want to see it happening, you know? Start the organization. Make it, you know, bring more kind of demographics and politics in there by just making it about opening up the election process, right? That can be nonpartisan. That can bring in, you know, because Green Party and Libertarians, we work together on various lawsuits and challenges and ranked choice balloting, which will be a segue to the next story, which is now written by Bill McKibben. I kept mentioning him for this reason, that I respect him because he actually starts 350.org. He actually does just not gripe about, we need an organization to do this. No, let's do it. But then 350.org is kind of weak because then they don't have a party to back. They are, it's up to endorsing single Democrats one at a time, not a party that is in opposition to them, but just the whole, we're going to lobby the people who are the barriers. This is the contradiction that I just like don't. I get why these activists or these participants think this way because, you know, I've lobbied the Senate and Assembly and I can see how you can sway their minds on like reforms that don't contradict their personal interests. But then if it's contradicting the party's interests, which a lot of these would, then the leadership will be the ones to say no. Not your local representative, which everyone when polled, likes and doesn't want to vote out of office, if it's a partisan district and whatnot. But leadership's got to be replaced. What does that mean? So Bill McKibben, like many others, said, you know, they don't hate the Green Party. They, you know, they think we should exist, but they're never going to join and they're never going to give money and they're never going to endorse our candidates. They say instead of challenging Joe Biden, being in opposition, an actual frickin' opposition, maybe the Green Party should help change our democracy. So here's another one of those instances where, just like with Angela Davis and others who say we need a new party that does X, Y, and Z, and then Green Party does do X, Y, and Z. This is another one. This would be N, random letter. Let's say it's D, D for democracy. And like, well, the Green Party does fight for ballot access and not just ballot access, but the ranked choice balloting. In fact, we were instrumental to getting it in Maine, which he mentions. So we can do both. We can be serious, not just run like vanity campaigns, as it's called by cynical Bernie bros. To distract myself from wondering if my chest is tightening, I sometimes think about other things that could go really wrong this year. The list is long, but somewhere near the very top is the thought that the president could somehow eke out a close election victory despite everything. Seems to be ignoring a lot. There's no guarantee it won't happen. He still like thinks Biden has a chance. That's what this is predicated on. That like the Green Party shouldn't be that we could actually hurt Biden's chances any more than they're actually low. Like he already has a low chance. There's no I'm going to be assertive. He has no chance. That's where we're coming from. You think he has a chance. Can you explain how he has a chance? How are these non-likely voters going to show up at the polls for him? It didn't happen last time. It's not happening now. What's different? There's no guarantee this won't happen. The Democrats didn't find a perfect candidate. And again, this is whether all this is the discussion between people who support, who are progressive. And they're trying to angle how to justify voting for Biden. He's not the perfect candidate. Well, Howie Hawkins isn't a perfect candidate either. Or at least he does. He wants to ban fracking. I'll put it that way. There's going to be an endless blizzard of Facebook lies, Team Trump, and top-notch voter suppression. I'm going to move on. But there are ways to lessen the odds a little. And a good one would be to not have a third-party challenge from the left this year, at least in the 6 or 7 battleground states. So again, then the walk back is, look, you know, I'm not saying the Green Party shouldn't run an opposition candidate, just not in battleground states. And then it becomes then a definition problem of, well, what are the battleground states? Is it Pennsylvania? Is Georgia in there? Like, how many states? Is it just Ohio and Florida? That's what comes to mind. But no, it's way more than that. Everywhere is a battleground. Everywhere. That was the case made in the last Green Party episode I did. And that means asking the Green Party to stand down in those places. You know, don't do our ballot drive. So then local Green Party activists that maybe want to do the local elections thing that is also said, like, look, I'm Green Party, minor party politics is fine, but running a presidential candidate is a vanity project. You should just focus on local elections. We can't do that without a presidential candidate. We can't do that without ballot drives. You're ignorant. You don't know this. Please, listen. Listen, we want to tell you about this. We want to tell you about why we do the things we do. But instead, there's just a dismissal. Your reasons are bad. That's the assumption. Our reasons for doing anything are bad. I don't have to listen to your arguments for why you do things. I have my bias, and that's enough. People with impressive left-wing credentials, you know, the type that sit behind a desk, and I say that derisively, but these include respected people, and I do myself, Noam Chomsky, Barbara Enderich, Ron Daniels, did this already in January in a well-argued open letter. Refer back to my episode, Green Party Blues, for my coverage of that. But it didn't work, seemed to work. The party's most likely presidential candidate, Howie Hawkins, declared that he would run even if the Democrats nominated Bernie Sanders, who Hawkins told an interviewer had been a little slow in his plans for reform. Hawkins has run many times for governor of New York and also for the House and Senate from that state, while never getting more than 5% of the vote. Actually, for governor, he did get more than 5% last time. It was 6, but that's the thing. That's actually the impetus for kind of the Green Party leadership kind of picking him as being the best person to run this year, is that, well, in various statewide races, he has gotten more than 5%. Maybe it could be done nationally. That's what we need to do. No one else has. He came really close in a city council race. He lost by, 20 votes after the election count. Recognizing the danger of Trump does not mean that electing any damn Democrat should trump all other considerations. This is Howie's words. Hawkins. So I probably won't be able to persuade him either, says McKibben. But at least let me offer suggestions that there's a particularly useful reform that Greens and others, so you can stress that, interested in a more vibrant politics could be working on instead this autumn. As if these things are mutually exclusive. But as far as individuals go, yes, it's really worth to just pick one thing and do it. Like how I do this show and not build my local party. I wish I could do both, but I can't. But at least, you know, let's take this as a suggestion that others should be fighting for it. And then that would make the Green Party viable, right? They won't support us until we're viable. And we're not viable until we have ranked choice ballots. Okay. Then you better be fighting for ranked choice ballots. But it's also circular in that who fights for ranked choice ballots? Who's the organization that does that? I'll give you a hint. It's the Green Party. I will tell you. It is the Green Party. That's what frustrates me about this rhetoric. He's making it sound like we don't do that, that we're not actually the organization that fights for it. Truly, we're not the only one, okay? But we are the prime mover. And then the coalition is built. To understand why this reform, ranked choice voting, seems so important to me, as it should be to anyone, let me say that by ideology, I'm pretty much a Green. He'll never register as one. He'll never endorse, I don't know if he's endorsed Green candidates. One of my favorite politicians anywhere is Bob Brown, a former member of the Australian Senate. Now, when he says Green Party, he actually means like a Green. Now, and then he mentions Australian Green or a European Green. Now, these are democratic socialists. These are parties that have operated for decades in their respective countries. And they're quite, they're, if anything, now part of the establishment in a way. They're not that radical or militant. And that's kind of why I would argue that they're not kind of, they don't grow that as much. So I'm about as small G green as green gets, having spent my adult life working on the greatest environmental crisis in our history, the rapid heating of our planet. But I haven't supported the Green Party in national elections in this country. He also doesn't seem to, I've never seen a headline of him supporting a local green for election either. So don't support national elections. Support like the Green Party, the state one in your area. Do that first then. But that's because of our electoral laws, as the previous guy talked about. The obvious difference between the U.S. and, on the one hand, and most of Europe and the rest of the world, is that we have a de facto plurality, winner-take-all two-party system, and that makes it all but impossible for a small party to make a non-perverse difference. While European countries have parliamentary systems, blah, 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 time and again, by winning 5, 10, or 20% and a like share of seats, the Greens who operate in parliamentary democracies have ended up with enough reps to give them bargaining power. And those bargains make big differences. Having the Greens in a power-sharing government was a major reason Germany pioneered renewables. Currently in British Columbia, a Green Liberal coalition has bolstered opposition to giant pipelines. In the U.S., winning a few percentage points of the vote gets you nothing except a chance to argue about whether you were a spoiler, an argument that Bill McKibben seems to enjoy propagating. Ralph Nader in 2000, Jill Stein in 2016 have roundly insisted that they weren't, arguing the Democrats who were defeated, but see, Bill McKibben then argues that they are. This is why he doesn't support Greens for national elections. Okay. What about local? You say you're a Green. Are you at least going to register? You can register Green and not vote. You can still vote Dem, you know. You can still, like, you don't have to vote for the party you're registered for. This is something that actually has to be explained by people who actually are new registers. So I'll do so again for your benefit. Because I care about you, and I respect you, that you can register for a party or no party and then vote for whatever in the general. Party registration affects what primary you vote in, thus determining the candidates for said parties, nothing else. Think of it like owning stock in a company. You can vote or have a vote based on your share count for the board or the CEO of the company you're in. And that's your effect by being a shareholder in that company. As a consumer in the market generally, then you could actually buy products from their competitor. In fact, that's actually a kind of form of corruption, that you could vote for maybe a bad CEO for a company because you actually buy products from the other company. You lose out on your stocks, I suppose, but maybe you own stocks in both. Maybe you actually own more stocks in the competitor. There you go. I figured out how you can make a lot of money and screw others. So if the Green Party candidate is on the ballot and attracts even a smidgen of support, well, it could end very badly indeed. He's making the spoiler argument. Hell with that. So the Green Party, reliterating that history seems less essential than looking ahead. No, please, let's reliterate it, because you have not made the case. Rather, enough people do make the case that we're spoilers. Spoiler. But they don't have proof. Let's see. The last poll I saw for Wisconsin showed that the race between a Democrat, and Trump for the state that many analysts predict will sway the election was currently within 3 percentage points. Oh, I'm so glad Bill McKibben trusts polls. They're so dependable. Like in 2016, when Hillary Clinton was polling 15 points ahead. That's not to say that America wouldn't be better off with more electoral alternatives. We clearly would. And to get them, we needn't wait for some unlikely constitutional change. Not like progressives vote for constitutional conventions. We had that chance in New York, and they all just endorsed not voting for it. Instead, we can work to get more states to follow the lead of Maine, which last year introduced a ranked choice voting system for most elections. Here's how it works. There are 10 candidates on your ballot, potentially. You list your choices from 1 to 10. You probably vote for your Green candidate as your number one. And if she comes in last, you haven't lost your vote or spoiled anyone else's chances. That's because the vote would then be eliminated and your second ranked choice would then be counted instead. And so on, until someone has won a primary. or a majority. You actually have to do win a majority. And first past the post, if there's, say, five candidates and the winner gets 30%, they're the winner. They don't have a plurality of any kind, but they still win. This is not some impossible dream of a reform. Pundits used to say, as Maine goes, so goes the nation. I never heard of that. And instead, indeed, last year, after Maine adopted the plan, so did New York City. And with, but I should mention that New York City's ranked choice ballot is only for Democratic primaries. It's not for the general election. So it's actually a half-baked reform that only benefits Democrats. If anything, it encourages people to be in just one party. It consolidates one-party rule. Wonderful. So any kind of reform that can be really good can also be twisted to be really bad or pretty bad. Keep that in mind. That's the importance of lobbying coming from a place of radical change, and we're not going to settle for half a reform, because half a reform can actually be worse than no reform. Because it could be a reform that is done that simply benefits the people already in power. And then they get to say, look, we did the thing you wanted to do. It only helped us in the end, but we did it. Everybody wins. Going about U.S. Before the pandemic, RCV, that's ranked choice voting, was gaining momentum with efforts teed up in several states to advance it via ballot initiative or legislative lobbying. Josh Silver, the director of Electoral Reform Campaign, Represent Us. Now, this is something that was actually fought for in Massachusetts, but then when it came to implementing it, the Democratic Party there in charge decided not to. They just stonewalled. And that's why, you know, Jill Stein was the leader of that effort, and she switched to Green because of that. There was a huge opportunity for legislative lobbying efforts in many other states, blue and red, as evidenced by the deep red Utah legislators' vote that allowed their cities to enact it. That is to say, green enthusiasts in Wisconsin and Pennsylvania could skip presidential campaigning and instead push their legislators hard to put RCV on the agenda. But then it's like, why would they do that unless you're doing it from a place of independent campaigning? That's my take on it, at least. Like, why would the legislator in Pennsylvania do ranked choice voting just by lobbying? You say, like, okay. So this is where it gets a little more muddied, and I'm less confident, and I'm going to be less assertive, I guess. But because I've lobbied state legislators, and one-on-one, when you make, like, the values argument of, like, this increases democracy, it increases participation, deep down they do care about these things individually. Now, as a institution, they are against it, and it will be stuck in committee forever. Ballot initiatives are a different process. In Maine, it was passed via ballot initiative, and it's been sued and challenged by the major parties every step in the way. Currently, it's only for statewide races and nowhere else. Not local, not even like state assembly. When I say statewide, I mean national, like national Senate, national congressman. That's ranked choice ballot is only active in Maine for that. The other side of the spectrum is ranked choice ballot has been introduced for individual cities on the city level, because that's where you can actually gather a mob and say, if you don't actually implement this, serious stuff is going to happen, ideally. But on the state level, I don't know. That's what's weird about this. McKibben is talking like, you know, the standard activist, like the kind that he's been doing. But then you ask, like, well, what's the effect that 350.org has had on the climate change debate? Like, legislatively speaking. We get the Community Climate Change Act here in New York, which is paltry. It's barely reform. It's just putting it in law that there's a goal. And a plan can be carried out. And what the plan isn't determined yet. And then even then, the goals aren't sufficient to flatten the curve of climate change. If we manage to enact this reform, the result would be a much better system in many ways. One is that you could really build small progressive parties without potential supporters worrying that they're overtly elect Trumpish figures. So this is an argument from feelings that we need this reform because it makes people feel better about voting or joining the Green Party or a minor party. It's true, right? People don't feel good about it, and that's why they're not doing it. It's not quite accepted, but it's always a kind of haranguing about, like, you know, you can't just use rational arguments. You got to use emotional ones too. Appeals to values like justice and freedom. And of course, the Green Party does all of this. But we don't have a good out. We don't have the outreach machine. Donate today, and we will. If the Greens or any third party is ever going to have a real breakthrough nationally, it will be because people can vote for them without fear, real or imagined. But maybe it would really help. You know what would really help about those imagined fears? If dipshits like Bill McKibben didn't actually stoke those imagined fears by making spoiler arguments, I think that would help. But there's another reason, too, which I got to see close up while covering elections as a young City Hall reporter in Cambridge, Mass., which for decades was the only major city in the country to use ranked choice voting. It's that these elections not only allow for more ideological diversity, but also tend to reduce the truly hateful divisiveness that becomes such a feature of our elections. If you're a candidate in a ranked choice election, you have a strong incentive not to be a sneering jerk to your competitors, because that kind of behavior reduces your chances of getting crucial number two votes. You have to make your case, and you have to at least understand someone else's. Obviously, campaigning for ranked choice voting is less sexy than campaigning for president. And it will take a little while, though the whole Green Party project seems premised on a kind of radical patience. Yes, it is. I think all oppositional politics is premised on that. I mean, isn't Bill McKibben? That's Bill McKibben's point, bag, is that he's not patient. So he wants to go straight to the top. He wants to lobby the president. And that means having a Democrat that's lobbyable, having a lobbyable person, even if they will actually not implement the agenda, take advantage of you. This is because, let's see, if the party insists on running a presidential candidate in the few states where it really matters, I hope people will not waste their votes on them. That's not because I think Joe Biden is a hero. It's because I think he's not only better than the alternative, but also pushable. I don't know why he thinks he's pushable. But Joe Biden has never been pushable. None of these moderate Democrats, none of these establishment Democrats are pushable. They never have been. Nominal progressive Democrats, yeah, they're the ones that change their mind and stuff and actually act on these values of freedom and actually... upping voter. They're the ones that enact the voting by mail and stuff. They're the ones who actually do care about voter enfranchisement. All right. They're not lying, but they're lower down on the pyramid. Let's skip ahead. I'm done with this. I hope it's never necessary to write any take on this subject again, and not because the Greens or any other idea-oriented parties. We're not idea-oriented. We're agenda-oriented. We have a platform. And the platform is fighting sexism. It's fighting for labor. It's doing all the things that these new party, you know, we need a new party people ask for. And I say, why not the Green Party? And they say, we're not serious. What makes you serious? The general question I have is, what makes your new party, what is your new party going to do better that the Green Party isn't doing? Like, how it will be better? How it will have more staying power than what the Green Party has been doing? This network of activists. And I don't know. I don't think they have an answer. I don't think there could be an answer. What will it do better? It'll be new. An argument from novelty. Well, not okay. I'm not okay with it. That's why I'm ranting about it. That's why I'm mad. That's why I'm frustrated. But you can find me online, Facebook, Three Left Show, and Twitter, The Three Left Show. Facebook and Twitter. On my way to starting a Twitch account or something like that. I think podcasting, looking at recent stats, is on its way out. It's old news now. Streaming, either on YouTube or Twitch, seems to be what is growing. So I think I may need to transition to that, whether I want to or not. Even if it doesn't gel with this community radio thing. I would like to do both. But it's something I'm thinking about. Trying to puzzle out. Otherwise, any feedback should be sent to me. I do want to hear it. My profound thanks for listening. Important skill. Important is talking. Capitalists and statists alike don't believe in this work. So support the show via a Patreon page that I've set up. and also become a supporting member of the station, WCAALP, Grand Street Community Arts. The last 10 episodes are always broadcast via most or all podcasting apps, but the full archive with show notes that includes all links to read referenced articles can be found at 3lefts.news, nothing else. Of course, the most important thing is to put these ideas and thinking and projects talked about here into practice yourself. Thanks. Until next time, wave the flags of the three lefts. Later.